You're tuned in to the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. It's almost time for an idea sparked a century ago, stymied by war, the Great Depression, and political indifference for decades. It's almost time for the opening of a space on the National Mall devoted to telling the story of the African-American experience and showing how it shapes the story of America writ large. It's almost time for us all to be able to get up close to those stories, told through shackles once worn by slaves, through sleeping car porter caps and commemorative coins, minted to celebrate the first inauguration of President Obama. It's almost time to open the doors. Here with us is the man who stands ready to fling them open to the world. Bonnie Bunch III is the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Lonnie, good to see you.
It's good to see you. Thank you for letting me come on board.
I thank you for coming on board. It's been a long time coming, that's for sure, and it's been a long journey for you since you were tapped to spearhead it. How are you feeling now that opening day is, well, close at hand?
Tired.
You can't be tired yet until afterwards.
You know, I'm really humbled. The fact that we are now, after 11 years, within 6 weeks of opening the museum, it just means a lot to me. It means so much because so many people have contributed to make this ideal real. I feel very strongly that what we've done is we obviously have fulfilled the dreams of many generations.
And your being here today tripped me out with guilt, so I went to the website this morning and made my contribution.
We appreciate that.
You can, too. You can go to our website and find a link to the website for the museum, or you, if you'd like to join the conversation with Lonnie Bunch, you can call 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. What are you most looking forward to seeing when the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture opens? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Lonnie, for those wondering how they can be part of the opening festivities and dedication on September 24th, the museum website has all the information you need. You can find a link to it at our website. What will the experience be, and what are you personally most looking forward to as a part of those opening festivities?
Well, I think there's something very powerful about having President Obama open the museum. You know, the fact that this has been a 100-year struggle, and to tie it to his administration, and quite candidly, to tie it at a time when race continues to divide us is really a key factor in our political discourse, that here is a museum that I think can help make us better. So that excites me.
You are Lonnie Bunch III. What do you think Lonnie Bunch I would make of this museum and your role in establishing it?
Oh, my grandfather died the day before I turned 5, and I just remember this very tall man who always smiled, and I think that he would be smiling thinking that his grandson had a little role in helping people to remember the rich history of Black America. I know what he'd say. He'd say, I hope you got some baseball in there, because he loved his baseball.
Well, he was from a part of the country where baseball was very, very popular.
That's right.
You spent your college years here in Washington, in fact, attending first Howard, then American University. How did your experience here shape you both as a young Black man in that era and your career as a historian?
I think Washington, D.C., more than any other place, has shaped who I am. I think I came to Washington in 1970, so you can imagine it's Chocolate City. Mm-hmm. The Black Panthers had a headquarters off of 17th Street. There was this amazing sense of cultural creativity. And I sort of immersed myself in this, the theater, listening to Roberta Flack perform. So in some ways, part of me was made culturally aware by my time in Washington. But the other thing that Washington taught me, though, was the importance of politics. That, you know, in Washington, you know, it was the last colony, the notion that struggle for equality also meant the political rights for the district. And it really sort of helped me realize that, you know, my desire to help make America better also was tied to helping making the district better.
I got here in 1969, and you just recited my exact history right here in Washington. All of the same influences at around the same time. The city has changed quite a bit since that time when you were first here as a college undergrad. What struck you most when you moved back after being in Chicago for some years?
Well, I mean, I think that there were neighborhoods that were always Black that are no longer. To be honest, I remember seeing people and thinking, How are they walking down the street? Who are they? And what amazed me is that Washington is still the city that's got this vibrant African-American culture. And what I want people to do is to remember that and to celebrate the culture that's still here.
Our guest is Lonnie Bunch. He's the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Here is Anita in Bethesda, Maryland. Anita, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was curious to know what will the museum exhibit in terms of those things that typically are not taught in Black histories. I'm a Black female, you know, and it's always the standard Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, George Washington Carver. But did you guys get into more of the nuanced things that a lot of people don't know, like scientific discoveries that Blacks have made, like the elevator and the red light and things like that?
I think what's important to realize is this museum has to, on the one hand, tell those big stories, maybe in new ways, of the Harriet Tubmans, of the Sojourner Truths. But then it really is to tell the nuanced history of a community. So while we'll tell the story of Garrett Morris and creating the stoplight, we'll also tell stories that people don't know, of individuals whose work transformed this country. I'm always struck by a story of a family named Trammell, who got their freedom in the 1850s, somebody nobody's ever heard of. But he made a little tin wallet because he wanted to protect that freedom paper. He knew that his family's future was tied to having that piece of paper. And we were given by the family the piece of paper and the tin wallet. We'll be able to tell stories in new ways, help people understand the richness of this history.
Thank you very much for your call. We got a tweet from someone who says, I hope the narrative does not begin with slavery and that there's some insight into our history pre-enslavement.
Well, the goal of the museum is to frame the African-American experience within a broader international context. So therefore, the museum begins in Africa. And looks at Africa before contact with Europe and Europe candidly before contact with Africa and takes us into the 21st century. The goal was to say that history matters and that history and shaping our lives continues to this very day. So for us, this is a story that will be complicated and nuanced.
Yes, this is Lonnie Bunch we're talking to. I knew this wouldn't begin with slavery, given the fact that you are a historian. Every April 16th, D.C. citizens mark Emancipation Day, the day over 3,000 enslaved persons were freed 8 months before the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. But ever since then, the Black residents of this city have had to fight for equal access to education, safe neighborhoods, freedom from discrimination. How prevalent will the story of this place, of this district, and its still disenfranchised citizens be within the museum?
One of the things that was really important to me is to remind everybody who comes to visit that they're in Washington, D.C. Often you come to the mall and you don't know where you are. You forget that you're in a city where people have lived. And so in this museum, we will tell historic stories. We'll tell the story of the Wormley Hotel, which was a hotel owned by African Americans right across from the White House that was so central to sort of the political history of the 19th century. And so for us, what we really want to make sure is that we will tell the story of Washington in a way to help people understand both its history, but also its continuing importance. Because Washington, with places like Howard University, have really been central not just to a local story, but to a national story as well.
Museums have a unique place in the fabric of the city. There are several already devoted to telling the story of African Americans, both large, like the Smithsonian's Anacostia Community Museum, and smaller, like the African American Civil War Memorial and Museum. How do you view the relationship between your institution or the institution that you'll be heading and these others?
It was clear to me that we couldn't do the work of building a new museum without standing on the shoulders of all those other institutions. That the work that Frank Smith did at the Civil War Memorial, or the work that goes back to John Kennard at the Anacostia Museum, has shaped not only who I am, but shaped what the museum is. What I realize is that our museum has to make sure that all boats rise. So our goal is to realize that people will come to this museum because it's new, because it's big, but we want to then push them back to local museums to say, here's what you love, what we talked about the Civil War. Go see what museums in Washington, or go see what the California African American Museum says. The goal here is to realize that we should be a place that helps people understand their local history as well as the national stories that we tell.
But a lot of debate around questions of whether to rename roads, bridges, and other public spaces named for Confederate Civil War figures throughout this region and in others. As a historian, what do you make of those arguments, and what role do you see this institution having in those conversations?
You had to ask me that, huh?
I did have to ask you that.
You know, as a historian, the one thing I know is the worst thing that can happen is when you erase history, is when you say that these things didn't happen. For me, I really like the fact that we can contextualize these stories. I think it's crucially important to understand not just who Robert E. Lee was, but how his image has been used some way to sort of create a mythologized past. And that for me, what's really important is to say, let's not erase or simply tear down. Let's contextualize. Let's make sure there are alternative images and statues and street names, so that basically what I want is to be able to walk through a country and see the names that reflect all of us, not just a single part of us.
On to the telephones again. Here's Benjamin in Washington, D.C. I think I know who this Benjamin is. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Yes, Jojo. Hi, it's been a little while. This is your former colleague.
Yes.
But anyhow, I spoke to Mercer Ellington some time ago in the Lincoln Theater, and I questioned him all the goodwill ambassadorship of your father, Duke Ellington. All he gets is a plaque on the side of a post office at 22nd and Ward Place, and I just feel that's a transgression. And so I'm curious about recognition of Duke Ellington, if not at that site, in more detail. Also, Benjamin Banneker. You know, the circle has been there almost 100 years at the end of Longfong Promenade, and the statue is still in the basement of the U.S. Capitol. What's taking so long to put that statue on the circle? It overlooks the waterfront, the fish market, and there's no statue. So those things have sort of stuck in my craw a little while, and I'm just curious, where are they going to get their full recognition?
Before Lonnie Bunch answers, I refer you to a program we did last year about the music that some of the curators will be bringing to this museum. We talked with Kevin Strait and Timothy Ann Burnside about bringing objects like Chuck Berry's Cadillac, Chuck D's boombox to the National Mall. You can check that out in our archives on May 7, 2015 at kojoshow.org.
And that for us, while I can't control what's going on in the Capitol, what I can do is make sure that the story of Duke Ellington is explored in the museum. And one of the most powerful objects we have is one of the original 1793 Benjamin Banneker almanacs that people are going to be able to see. So we really feel that part of our goal is to push people so they recognize there are other places to go to see this story. And we hope that, therefore, more people will tell the story of Duke Ellington or Benjamin Banneker.
Thank you very much for your call, Benjamin. Moving on to Carl in Washington, D.C. Carl, your turn.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for receiving my call. All I want to know is, there's a time pass procedure in terms of entering the museum, because I have family members who like to, you know, visit the museum from out of town and whatever. So are there passes being passed out for a time limit to be in the museum? That's all I need to know.
Starting next week, there will be passes available. And so you go onto our website, and then we'll tell you exactly where to go to get time passes for at least the first year of the opening of the museum.
And what are the limits on time?
The time will be probably every 15 minutes to get people in. Okay. The tickets are obviously free. We're the Smithsonian.
Thank you very much for your call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll return to this conversation. But you can still call us, 800-433-8850. Have you been a donor to the museum, either through an item or with a financial contribution? Do you have plans to volunteer there? Tell us what pushed you to get involved, 800-433-8850, or send us email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nambi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. Our guest is Lonnie Bunch III. He's the founder and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opens on September 24th. You have said the stories this museum tells will highlight the truth, both the miseries of slavery and the joy that exists within the African American community. As you're ready to open the doors, we, as a nation, are still struggling with those truths, especially around issues of criminal justice, police brutality, and the black community. What role do you see this museum having in addressing those issues, both in putting them in historic context and maybe in helping to move us forward?
I think this museum has to be as much about today and tomorrow as it is about yesterday. So on the one hand, we look at the criminal justice system and we historicize this issue. We talk about how it is an evolution out of slavery to sort of control African-American men by putting them into the criminal justice system. But our goal is also to create programs that allow us to discuss these issues contemporarily, to try to help people find solutions. My goal is to recognize that it's not enough to come to a museum to celebrate and remember. What has to happen is the museum has to be a safe space where you can debate, where you can struggle, where you can point to, where you can try to move the country along. Our goal is to make America better, and therefore we will be talking about moments, as I said, that'll make you smile and moments that'll make you cry.
You know, when you mentioned the Black Panther Party headquarters in D.C. earlier, you hear the Black Panther Party referred to, especially in today's Black Lives Matter movement, as an organization that simply advocated violence. You don't hear a great deal about the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. You don't hear a great deal about their breakfast program, which is what made them ultimately so popular in Oakland and the like. Will that kind of history be covered in this museum?
Absolutely. I think one of the things for us is to be able to go deep into these stories so that people will be able to understand why there were perceptions of the Panther Party in certain arenas and certain communities, but also what they really believed in. We keep being brought back to the words of John Hope Franklin, the great historian, who always said to me, our job is to do two things. One is to tell the unvarnished truth, and two, to help people be changed by this experience.
The amazing thing about John Hope Franklin to me was that when I met him in his 90s, he was just as sharp as he was in his 40s.
He was just as sharp and he was just as determined to make America confront its tortured racial past. One of the great joys of this job was that until he died for at least 5 or 6 years, he ran my scholarly advisory committee. And I'd sit down next to him, you know, 4 times a year, and he'd teach me, he'd school me.
You've said that daunting as raising the money for this museum has been, which we'll get to in a minute, you were more concerned with building the collection. Now, I know a lot of people who believe their mother's grandfather's Bible belongs in this museum. How difficult was it to bring all the pieces together? I got to tell you, I've run into bunches of people who said, my mother's father's grandma's Bible deserved to be in that museum.
Well, the challenge is, this was the only national museum that had to start from scratch in all areas. Didn't have a staff, didn't have money, didn't have collections, didn't have a building. So for me, while I thought that we could raise the money, I knew at the Smithsonian, you had to have the great stuff of history. That if you had all technology, it would be nice, but it would fail because people come to the Smithsonian to see the Wright Flyer or the Greensboro Lunch Counter that I collected years ago. So my notion was, how do we go around the country and find things? So the belief was that so much of our history, 20th century, 19th century, and even some of the 18th century, was still in the basements, trunks, and attics of people's homes. So we went around the country, we stole the idea of Antique Roadshow, and said, bring out your stuff. We're not going to tell you how valuable it is. We're going to help you preserve Grandma's old shawl, that wonderful 19th century photograph. Then what would happen is people would say, well, we want to give this to you. We would say, first of all, give it to the local museums. When we were down in Birmingham, we were in New York City. And then, if it was in the scholarly parlance, really cool, it came back to D.C.
On to the telephones. Well, of all the items in the collection, is there one thing you've seen? You mentioned one already, the card, the can that was made for the card. Mm-hmm. One story you've heard, item from this region that's really stuck with you?
Well, I mean, I think that the silverware, we collected silver from the Wormley Hotel. And the Wormley Hotel, now you've got to understand how important, this was the place where all the politicians came. And in fact, one of the greatest historical moments in America was the Compromise of 1876, which ends Reconstruction. That compromise was worked out in the Wormley Hotel. And so to have material from that hotel lets us talk about black businesses, lets us talk about D.C., but also let's talk about politics. So those are kind of things that sort of make me happy every day.
On to the telephones again. Here now is Ramey in Washington. Ramey, your turn.
Hello. How are you gentlemen doing?
Doing well.
We've come a long way since Negro History Week back in the early 50s. But I had a grave concern about what the museum won't be as opposed to what it will be. As one of your callers noted earlier, we get the same story every week, every year. The Boy Scout version, the George Washington Carver. I'm not trying to minimize what he's done, but just the usual things, the usual things. But there was one of the biggest atrocities in black history that no one is willing to discuss. I had the honor of working on a documentary of this woman. Her name is Claudette Colvin. She was a teenager and the first person to really refuse to give up her seat, and she was arrested. Her name is not mentioned. She did this several months before Rosa Parks. The NAACP came up with a number of bogus reasons why they wouldn't recognize what she had done and her accomplishment. And there was a second incident, and I'll just get your response.
Let's get them one at a time.
The reality is I knew her, and her story is in the museum. I think that in a way, that's what I mean about nuance, that the story is not just Rosa Parks. The story is also, here is this young woman who, because people thought that she didn't represent the community in a certain way, she wasn't considered the person to lead this struggle to change. So we want to tell all those stories in this museum.
Thank you very much for your call. Museums are also facing new challenges as technology evolves. Yours is the first new Smithsonian institution to open in this social media age. How are you taking that into account and aiming to appeal to young visitors in particular?
I guess one of the biggest challenges was how to utilize technology. So what we did is, rather than build a traditional museum and then figure out how to use social media, we had people coming together from the very beginning saying, what's the role of technology in everything? So what we have are the kind of handheld devices that allow you to choose your tour. You want to go more deeper about women, you can do that on your handheld device. We've got a lot of apps that allow you to be able to, for example, come to the mall and see what was once on the mall. And so the goal for us was to really recognize that we needed to build a platform, because we knew technology would change. So what we want to do is just be nimble. And the smartest thing I ever did was hire a bunch of kids. They probably look like they're 12, but they might be 25.
Well, I should have mentioned this earlier. Since our caller mentioned Negro History Week, we do have to talk about the founder, Carter Woodson, and the Association for the Study of First Negro Life and History, and then later African-American Life and History.
I think that I've said publicly that there would be no museum without the association, without Carter G. Woodson. I mean, here is somebody who not only brought the best scholarship, but he made sure that that scholarship was shaped by all the work that's being done by librarians and amateur historians. And he basically laid a foundation that we built upon. So the story of Carter G. Woodson is in the museum. And so we thought it was really important to make sure that we honor not just Carter G. Woodson, but honor the fact that he opened a door that allowed so many people to find ways to celebrate and to be made proud and to be made better by the African-American experience.
On now to Jim in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Jim, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I just want to remind people of your guest's great contribution to straightening out history, especially black history. He was responsible for an initial grant that Jim Lowen got to write Lies My Teacher Told Me, which is a book that exposes all the baloney in U.S. high school history books. And I'm papering the world with that book. And I was thinking of Lonnie this morning when I UPS two copies to a good friend of mine who's about to start a graduate program at Princeton. But hooray for you, Lonnie.
Thank you very much for your call. Tell us about that book.
Well, I've been very lucky. You know, one of the joys of the Smithsonian is you get to meet some of the best people in the world. And very early in my career, Jim Lowen was a fellow working for me who was working on this book, this idea. And I remember talking to him, wrestling with it. And it was just such a wonderful idea because what he did was he made complex history accessible to people. So for me, that has inspired me to say my job as a historian is, yes, to do the scholarly research, but more importantly for me, make it accessible so the public finds a useful and usable past.
The National Mall occupies a unique spot both in the district and the nation. When you walk up to and into the building on 14th and Constitution Northwest, how does that bronze corona design fit into and amplify the history of that particular space?
Well, first of all, when we talked about building a building, there were several things I wanted. First of all, I wanted this building to be the first green museum on the mall. I think it's very important to talk about sustainability. But also, what I wanted it to be was to do something that was distinctive, but would still, as I use the term, sing with the rest of the mall. And so when we came up with this corona idea, what really made it work for me was the notion that we took this bronze corona, but they were initially trying to figure out, well, what's the design on it? And I said, look, I don't want to just make holes. Why don't we do something that says, let's look at all the kind of creativity of enslaved craft people from Charleston and New Orleans and did all that beautiful ironwork. Let's take that and put it on the building. And that's what's on the corona. And so what the corona is yes, it's a homage to Charleston and to New Orleans, but it really is a homage to the fact that so much of African-American history has been hidden in plain sight. And what we hope it does is stimulate interest of people looking in their neighborhoods, reading those wonderful signs that are in the district so they know what happened when they walked down 14th and G.
You can't go by that building without wanting to go in it at this point. So starting September 24th, that's what you'll be able to do. Lonnie Bunch is our guest. He is the founder and director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. If you'd like to join the conversation with him, call us at 800-433-8850. Where do you think this new museum fits into our current local landscape of historical institutions? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Here's Campbell in Washington, D.C. Campbell, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Kojo. And I'm a founding member of the museum. And I'm looking for the North Star as well. I want to mention that in terms of additional information for the museum, as you know, both of you well know, African Americans weren't just bystanders to history. We were involved in making history. And one of the things that I think is significant relates to my grandfather, who was Colonel Campbell Johnson, who was Assistant Director of Selective Service. And he had brought about the opportunity for Japanese American citizens to participate in World War II as part of our armed forces. And they served heroically in the 442nd in taking over Italy. Additionally, I just wanted to mention that another thing is that the integration of the armed forces, my grandfather in his many years with Selective Service was not just a bystander to history. He was, in fact, someone who caused history. Last point is that he was also 12th Street Y. He devoted his entire life to advancing inclusion of African Americans. He was executive secretary of the 12th Street YMCA, which had the first swimming pool at which people of color were able to swim in, and also the first summer camp where blacks could have an opportunity to participate. Well, so these are things that just, I think, the mission of the museum is just absolutely wonderful, and I certainly intend to be volunteering, and I am going back through my basement and getting a lot of this information
from
out.
The award. Obviously, you're very proud of your grandfather, but the military is a big part of this collection, too, isn't it?
Very much so. I was really pleased that we were able to find material going back to the American Revolution. One of the artifacts I love the most is a powder horn that was used, you know, to load a gun, a musket. And it was a powder horn owned by an African-American soldier in the Revolution, Prince Simbo. And he carved his name on, and he said he was from Connecticut. And what I love is on the back, there's a dove, and in the mouth of the dove is the word liberty. So here is somebody who, born enslaved, gained his freedom, but was really crucial in sort of changing America and helping it become the nation it became.
Thank you very much for your call, Campbell. We move on now to Angela in Washington, D.C. Hi, Angela.
Hello. I saw online that you guys are having a three-day celebration for the grand opening. I wanted to hear a little bit more about what type of artists and fashion and what things would be on display during the festivals preceding the opening of the museum.
One of the things we wanted to do was realize that when this museum opens, it's going to be like a mini inauguration. There's going to be 50, 60,000 people, and that it's no way to get everybody in the museum at the same time. So what we did is we actually came up with the idea of taking a kind of mini folk festival, a three-day celebration that will begin on Friday the 23rd and the 24th and 25th, where you'll be able to, in addition to the going to the museum, you'll be able to hear Public Enemy perform, or you'll be able to hear spoken word from local artists here in D.C. You'll be able to sort of see amazing murals that are being created. You'll be able to sort of use your social media to talk about history and to tell your story, your oral history. So in a way, the goal here is to say that this is a celebration of the richness and diversity of culture, and it's part of the way we celebrate and honor all those who were involved with opening a museum.
Angela, thank you very much for your call. Hope you enjoy the opening in her speech at the Democratic National Convention. Michelle Obama noted that every day she wakes up in a house at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue that was built by slaves. You mentioned his name earlier, but how significant is it that the ribbon will be cut on the museum this fall by our nation's first black president?
Well, I love the fact that any national museum deserves the attention of the president of the United States. The fact that this president is somebody whose election, his administration has transformed the country, it's been an amazingly historically important moment. I think it's very powerful to say that this president will get to open this museum. We're very honored and humbled by that.
We got a tweet from someone who says, please ask Dr. Bunch, what is the plan for linking the museum to schools, districts, and teacher education programs?
I have said that education is the number one priority of this museum, and I've got gifted educators who are already creating an amazing array of programs. We have something called Meet the Museum, which is an online opportunity for District of Columbia teachers so they can find out the resources, get a look at the material, get a look at the tours. We also have created a series of educational programs virtually and then actually helping teachers talk about race. How do you teach race? So that we've really said that let us look at the variety of ways we can contribute to improving the educational system. One of the things that's really important to us is that we've decided to also focus on young children. People come to history late, but yet it'd be very powerful to have 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old kids understand that history is about fairness, things that they can understand. So for us, it really is important to craft the tours that you would expect, the kind of curriculum material, but we realize education is the key to our success.
But that also means that the digital environment gives that access to teachers all over the country and, for that matter, the world.
Absolutely. We realize that we've been getting calls from around the world saying, if you could help us understand how an African-American experience is a quintessential American experience, that'll help us think about race in Ecuador or race in France. So our goal is to craft these programs, this educational material, to help people wrestle with these things. But we expect this to be, as all the Smithsonian is, a national and international institution.
Got to take a short break. If you've called, stay on the line. We'll try to get to your calls. If you'd like to call us at 800-433-8850. The lines are busy. Shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. Where do you think this new museum fits into our current local landscape of historical institutions? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back to our conversation with Lonnie Bunch III. He is the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, which is set to open on September 24th. Lonnie, raising money is obviously a big piece of your job, and it's been a big job. Congress allocated half the funding for the museum, leaving you to come up with another $270 million, which has been made of donations, some from celebrities like Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey, who sits on your board. What was your strategy in going out to raise that money when it came to the big donors you were going after?
I think, first of all, the strategy was to say, this is not simply an African-American museum for African-Americans. That the story of Black America is the quintessential American story. It's the story that has shaped us all. If we're interested in our notions of freedom, citizenship, equality, where better to look than within this community? So basically, by framing it as a two-sided coin, yes, this is an insider's perspective about Black history, but it's also the story for us all. As I like to call it, this is a people's journey, but it's a nation's story. And that has really been very, very positive in terms of our success. Candidly, also our success was that we were able to put together an amazing board. People like Oprah and Ken Chenault of American Express and Dick Parsons, formerly of Time Warner. These people gave of themselves for more than a decade, allowed me, they opened doors, they got me into conversations. But ultimately, what did it was the combination of the Smithsonian, people's real passion and interest, and the fact that we now had, after 50 years of good scholarship, amazing stories to tell.
You took a page from the public radio playbook as well and started an early membership program. And you did it, is my understanding, against advice from the Smithsonian. Why was that important to you?
Well, early in my career, when I actually did honest work as a historian, right, I was talking to this old woman. Oh, she's probably my age now, but this woman seemed very...
Does that happen to you all the time? I was talking to this elderly person, and actually, that person was younger than I am.
Exactly. So this woman said to me, she said, you can have this oval photograph that was on the wall, but you can't have what was stuck in the frame. So I climbed up on these boxes, and I pulled it down, and in the frame was her father's membership card from the NAACP from 1913. And I never forgot how important that sense of ownership was. So when I came back and I thought, how do we get people to care? Let's give them ownership. And so when people thought membership, they said, oh, you're trying to make money, it's going to cost. And I said, no, what I'm trying to do is give people a sense of pride that they own this museum. And then the other thing, candidly, is to help with Congress, I needed to show that there were people around the country that cared. So what I did is I took the members and actually have it broken down by congressional district. So I can tell you how many members in every congressional district. And so it really was a way to sort of make real. And the fact that we have now over 100,000 members really is very powerful to me.
I own a piece of that joint, I'll have you know. Here's Carol Ann in Bethesda, Maryland. Carol Ann, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. It's good to talk to you again. Your story and Lonnie Bunch's story was the same as mine. I came in 65, and I moved into Anacostia because I got a kindergarten job at the Ketchum School. And I heard that a Frederick Douglass house was in the neighborhood. I had never heard of Frederick Douglass. Can you imagine coming from Brooklyn and never reading in Black history about Frederick Douglass? So I'm so committed to the idea of your museum. I did become a donor, a small check, a Bernie Sanders-sized check, but nevertheless a check, and I really do hope to spend lots of time down there. I can't wait, and I'm just thrilled for your success.
Thank you very much for your call.
And thank you for your support. I mean, the reality is, to make this work, thousands and thousands of Americans had to care. Had to write small checks, had to sort of, you know, become members. And that means a lot to us because it means that this is an idea whose time has come.
Thank you very much for your call. Here's Juanita in Washington, D.C. Juanita, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hello, Kojo and Mr. Bunch. I'm calling because I, too, gave a little best I could, you know, help with the project. And can't wait for the opening and all that. But I had... one time sent you a kind of a little letter explaining something. My great-grandfather, make this short, hopefully. My great-grandfather was an inventor. He invented something called the pea picker. Did you? And his name was Benjamin Hicks. And we had sent, well, I did. I think some of my other family members may have contacted you also.
Was that a peanut-picking machine? Was that a peanut-picking machine?
Yeah, it's the machine. It's a big old rusty-looking machine. If you go down down through Petersburg today, you'll see it. As a matter of fact, it's in the Agricultural Museum. And
I was about to mention it's probably in a museum someplace.
Yeah, and it's an industrial... a farm museum, like a farm museum. I've been there, but it's in Cortland, Virginia.
Okay, let me ask Lonnie Bunch if he knows anything about that.
One of the things that is really important to me is to recognize that no one building can hold all this history. So part of what we tried to do is when people have great stories, we try to make sure local museums are also telling those stories. And the story of your grandfather, great-grandfather is really important. For me, maybe the greatest strength of the museum is to get people to share those stories, to share it with their children, to get them in museums, because the more of that information's out there, the better the country is.
Thank you very much for your call, Juanita. Here is Stu in Rockville, Maryland. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for this program. This is wonderful. I always thought, I was amazed back even 20 years ago how they welcomed the museum for African-American history on the wall. It just seemed like a big hole. I'm glad you're finally filling that. Question, this sort of goes back to a question that was raised about 15 minutes ago. There were a number of very hot topics in addition to criminal justice, such as voter registration and private versus public education, that at least in my amateur historian eye seem like an absolutely direct link from, you know, Reconstruction to today. Is the museum going to address those issues frontally, or are they going to be very coy about it, or are they going to, you know, how are they going to handle it?
I've not been very good at being coy, so that's not who I am. The reality is that no exhibition can cover everything, but I think the combination of the stories we tell in the museum, the kinds of public programs that we do that will allow us to raise these issues, the role that we use of the internet and the virtual world will allow us to sort of help the public grapple with these issues. My goal is not to give people the answers. My goal is to give people the opportunity to find that safe space where we can come together, we can debate, we can fight, but we can try to move this country forward.
Thank you very much for your call. Victor, who is at Reagan National Airport in Virginia, has the kind of question only a cab driver can have. Victor, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call, Kojo. Like you said, I'm a cab driver, and I drive people around it every single day. And there's a question which pops up every day. They ask me, what would be in the room, in the house?
What's in that building right there? You want to be able to tell them what they can find in that building?
Uh-huh.
Well, Lonnie Bunchen,
well,
20 seconds or less.
You know what you can find? You can find a true story of America. You'll find amazing materials that we brought up from a sunken slave ship to help people understand the slave trade. You'll actually be able to see a cabin that the enslaved people lived in on Edisto Island in South Carolina. You'll also be able to see this amazing clothes that Cab Calloway wore when he performed. You'll be able to see some of the most amazing material of television and theater, August Wilson material, material from Dreamgirls. I just think that in a way, what the goal of the museum is to give you this rich cornucopia of culture and history that I think will move us and help us as a nation.
You'll find that a lot of your trips from Reagan National are being cut short when you get to 14th and Constitution. And you're going to have to find a way to pick those people back up after they spent 3 hours in the museum. But thank you very much for your call. The museum that most recently preceded yours in opening on the Mall, the National Museum of the American Indian, is fascinating, yes, but it also has a stellar local reputation as being the place to eat if you're down on the Mall for the day with visiting friends. Will you be aiming to give them a run for their money?
My notion is I steal from the best, and that's one of the best restaurants. And so what we're doing is actually doing regional cuisine so that you'll come into the museum and you'll be able to get Low Country, South Carolina food. You'll be able to get food from New Orleans. You'll be able to get sort of barbecue from the West and seafood from the Chesapeake. So the goal is to recognize that this is a place of learning, but some of that learning comes by how well you eat.
on to Karen in Haymarket, Virginia. Karen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to see this museum, and I wanted to ask Mr. Bunch if he has, I'm sure he's heard of Katherine Johnson, but if there's going to be an exhibit about her in the museum. She was an amazing African-American woman. She graduated high school at 14 and college at 18, and she went to work for NASA, and she was instrumental in sending Apollo 11 to the moon and back. It was her duty to calculate orbital trajectories and flight times. And she was so good that John Glenn asked her to double-check the results of computer calculations before his flight, the first by an American.
That's an amazing story. And part of what we want to try to do is, as we talk about questions of gender, is to make sure that story is one of them. I mean, I think that the what I love about building this museum is that we've uncovered so many other stories that people like you have shared with us, and that we're going to be able to sort of build on these as we go into the future. The great strength of the museum is that once the museum is open, once the building is complete, it means that as long as there's an America, there's a chance to tell that story, and there's a chance to add new stories to it. So we're excited about not just what you'll see when we open, but how the museum will evolve over time.
Thank you for your call, Karen. We got a tweet from J.C. McCahill who says, will the museum recognize the unique and continuing battle for equality of black LGBTQ Americans? This seems a great venue for it.
I think it's really important that we recognize that the African-American experience has been an amazingly diverse experience, and the LGBT community is an important part of that story. And there are moments in the museum where we tell that story. For example, we tell the story of how, in some ways, when Martin Luther King and the March on Washington, whose stories they told versus whose they didn't tell. So that, in essence, for us, we want to make sure that we illuminate all the dark corners.
Here now is Gabriel in Washington, D.C. Gabriel, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, wow. This is so cool. Okay, hi. I'm Gabriel. I'm from D.C. I grew up there. I'm 21, and every time I go back from college and come back, it just, the city changes, you know, with gentrification and everything. So, my question is, and then just being, you know, being young, being in school and learning history. I went to an HBCU and learning.
Okay, you got to come with your question because we're running out of time.
Sorry. Yeah, my bad. I'm sorry. Pretty much, I want to know, like, how are you going to talk about things like the burning down of Black Wall Street and, you know, things that we didn't really learn in school, I think purposely in a lot of ways. And, you know, just stories that are darker.
You will be surprised by the rich array of stories. For example, we have an amazing gallery that part of it looks at the burning of Tulsa. It tells that story, and there are three artifacts there that are going to amaze you. We have found three pennies that were burned in one of the houses that were destroyed, and we have those pennies given to us by the family. So we will be telling stories that are difficult as well as stories that offer our sense of resiliency.
Got about 30 seconds left. What's left for you to do before you open the doors?
Oh, my goodness. Figuring out how to service almost 50,000 people who will come to the opening. What's left for me is to thank the staff, who has done amazing work that most people will never know what they did.
What's on your calendar for September 25th?
Sleep.
The day after the door's open, he's going to sleep for like 3 weeks.
That's exactly right.
Lonnie Bunch III, he's the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Lonnie, always a pleasure. Good luck to you.
Oh, thank you. It's always great to be with you.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more for you online. Be sure to check out the conversation we had with some of the curators at the Smithsonian's National Museum for African American History and Culture working on their music collection. That's from May of last year. You'll find it at kojoshow.org. Remember, if you're heading out of town this August seeking relief from the climbing temperatures, we love to travel. Take this show with you by subscribing to the broadcast via your favorite podcast app. Whatever your plans, be sure to meet us back here tomorrow at noon. We'll be talking about the sentencing of businessman Jeffrey Thompson, the man behind the 2010 shadow campaign of Mayor Vincent Gray, what his plea deal means for justice in the far-reaching corruption case, plus what's next for residents who lost everything in a building explosion in Silver Spring. That's all coming up tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Angelisa Schroepsdorf, Kayla Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleinman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.